This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you, my fellow Americans, are citizens of Assassination Nation, a nation brought into being by America's first African-American president, standing on the shoulders of giants of warfare, of spycraft, of technology, and the rationalization of violence in the name of America's greater moral principles. Over the next hour, we shall see how the Obama administration may have brought us into a new era of warfare, conflict, and international relations where unilateral action and violation of international borders is the hallmark, stealth is the strategy, and drone aircraft are the frontline weapons. One slightly frustrating problem, we mostly miss our targets. Our intelligence is regularly suspect, and the complications to international relations and the identity of America as an exceptional nation with an almost holy mission of world peace seems to be the chief casualty here. This is President Obama's sketchy outline of the operational rules of the use of drones in assassinations back in September of 2012 on CNN.
It has to be a target that is authorized by our laws. It has to be a threat that is serious and not speculative. It has to be a situation in which we can't capture the individual before they move forward on some sort of operational plot against the United States. And this is an example of where I think there's been some misreporting. Our preference is always to capture if we can, because we can gather intelligence.
The actual criteria written in a variety of classified and unclassified documents and public statements, it has to be a target authorized by law, a serious, non-speculative threat, where capture is simply impossible before a plot against the United States becomes a reality, and avoiding civilian casualties at all costs. The journalism investigative organization The Intercept has assembled a detailed panorama of this policy from classified documents and sourced interviews that accuse the United States of killing people they deem who are threats, quote, people who have no rights, no dignity, who have no humanity. They are simply designated, quote, selectors to a drone pilot who pulls the trigger. Furthermore, The Intercept source says over the past 14 years, the national security establishment has become, quote, addicted to this machine, to this way of doing business, that it seems like it's going to be harder and harder to pull them away from it the longer they're allowed to continue operating in this way. Let's get some more details now from Ryan Devereaux, staff reporter at The Intercept. He's the lead reporter on the Drone Papers piece on Afghanistan, manhunting in the Hindu Kush. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, the president saying we'd rather capture than kill them, that's complete bunk based on your investigation.
Well, so the investigation that I worked on looked at the special operations campaign from 2011 to 2013, and it compares raids, you know, on the ground where they grab detainees and airstrikes, and you see dozens of detainees grabbed, and you see, you know, over a couple hundred people killed in airstrikes. And of course, the big difference there is that in a raid, you can grab people, take them in, interrogate them, and if, you know, they aren't the right person, you could conceivably let them go. But in airstrikes, that's not an option. You know, there's a tremendous number of people that were killed in the course of this particular campaign in the effort to, you know, take out a few specific individuals.
Can you describe generally how America's technological superiority is used to take cell phone data, cell phone information, electronic metadata, transmit it into GPS coordinates, put it on the screen of a drone operator, et cetera?
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty big concern, even within some sort of circles within the military special operations community, is that this has become a sort of obsession with what the United States can do with this sort of technology. That you can track a cell phone, you can track it, you know, in these very remote places, and it seems like you have a really good sense of your target and where your target's moving and what they're doing. But really, what you're doing is watching a cell phone. You know, in the absence of human intelligence or, you know, anything to corroborate what you think you're looking at, you're basically tracking a piece of technology around. And there's concerns, certainly from our source on these stories, that has become a really driving factor in these so-called targeted killing operations.
A beep is a defendant. A beep is a terrorist, when in fact a beep could be a lot of things.
Exactly. I mean, the source described situations and, you know, repeated sort of situations where, you know, you would think that you're going after a real hot target, and it turns out that this is just the phone of a mother of a target.
Is there any serious repercussion there, or is it just a oops?
So one of the most sort of striking components of the Afghanistan story that I worked on is that the source basically described that you know, there's a practice when you're dealing with these sort of operations in really remote places like the border regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan, where a missile hits a suspected target and a number of people are killed alongside that target, and those people are deemed enemies killed in action unless evidence emerges to prove otherwise. If they're military-age males, MAMs, as they're called in military parlance, and then he says, you know, without a doubt, then those folks are going to be labeled EKIA, enemies killed in action, unless there's some reason to believe that they weren't, that emerges later.
So accuracy, 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10?
So there's a stretch of time in the campaign that I look at. It lasted basically through the summer 2012. It was right after the Obama administration decided to sort of shift gears in Afghanistan, draw down the big army type of war and focus on special operations, right? And so they ramped up the airstrikes in this particular campaign. And the data in the military's own documents indicates that over that period, nearly 9 out of 10 people who were killed in the airstrikes were not the intended or direct targets of those strikes.
Oh, so 1 out of 10 accuracy.
So 1 out of 10. So there's a term that they use, and it's a jackpot or JP. So jackpot or JP is when you either capture or kill the person that the mission is aiming to remove from the battlefield. So if you get that person, capture him, kill him, then that's a jackpot. And so what the documents do is break down the sort of rate of jackpots compared to EKIA, so anyone else who's killed in the strikes. And over the course of this entire campaign, you had 35 jackpots and over 200 EKIA.
Can I back you up for a second? Let's just focus on the language for a moment.
Yep.
Jackpot, EKIA, right. Acronyms are famous in the military. But we've also got baseball cards here being used to identify targets, all kinds of weird fantasy sports language to describe fantasy slaughter.
Right. Touchdown is another one.
Yeah. What's that mean?
Touchdown is when you hit the phone that you were looking for.
Ryan Devereaux, where do you go from here?
We go on reporting on these sorts of issues, and we hope that something changes.
The Intercept contacted folks in the administration at all levels of the security establishment and the White House, and all were told they didn't comment on, quote, classified materials. Ryan Devereaux, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Devereaux is a staff reporter at The Intercept. You might call this jackpot number one, November 2002.
Needless to say, he's been an individual that has been sought after as an Al-Qaeda member as well as a suspected terrorist connected to the USS Cole, so it would be a very good thing if he were out of business.
Then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking about the death of Al-Qaeda Senyan al-Harti, a suspected terrorist involved in the USS Cole bombing, likely the first victim of a U.S. drone strike outside of a combat zone. November 2002. We're a long way from then. How does our current drone program compare, and what sorts of tensions of morality, of tactics, of strategy, of due process for that matter, does it raise? Joining us now, Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. He's also Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. First of all, your just impression of the Intercept window that they bring on the whole drone program.
Well, it's a great scoop. We do have, really for the first time, we have the actual inside documentation of this ghastly machine that's been built up over these last few years to carry out manhunting. For all the talk of high-tech precision or precise precision, as our president likes to call it, of these killings, it's actually pretty haphazard. I mean, that sort of ghastly, that statistic of when they were embarked on their, whatever they call it, haymaker or something, campaign in on the Pakistani-Afghan border a couple of years ago, 35 of the people they killed were the people they sort of set out to kill. There were 200 others or 200 people they sort of got killed along the way. So, you know, what we've all been saying for years is that, you know, this was actually a pretty haphazard business and they were just killing a lot of innocent people along the way, you know, confirmed from the inside. So, yeah, I was pretty interested to see everything I've said absolutely there in black and white.
It seems like the technology of drones, for some reason, postpones or allows us to completely ignore the notion that human beings die.
Yes, well, the purported technology of drones. I mean, as I just said, you know, it turns out it does inflict rather a lot of casualties, or at least, you know, other people. Yes, indeed, it saves American lives. Except that, does it really? Because, yes, you know, you can go out and, you know, knock off Mr. So-and-so, you know, from the safety of your armchair in, you know, in a trailer in Nevada, or from the safety of the Oval Office. But we're still at war. We've been at war now since 2001. As Obama said yesterday, the war's going to go on a bit longer. So, you know, in the short term, yes, it saves American lives. In the longer term, the war seems to go on and on and on. Doesn't actually get us anywhere.
Well, let's take two arguments then. How do you respond to the, we've had no terrorist attacks, we're absolutely safe here in the United States, all of what we are doing is responsible for this. So, Mr. Coburn, please cease and desist.
Well, no, that's very nice. You know, we weren't hit. We weren't attacked by giant lizards either. Do we? You know, do we thank the drone program for that? I mean, they use this excuse. Thanks to our wonderful drone program, we've kept the terrorists at bay. I think people might also be noticing that during that time, September 2001, Al Qaeda was basically, they lived in caves in Afghanistan. They lived, you know, there was just a few hundred of them in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Nowadays, Al Qaeda, or you know, its spin-offs, they occupy territory the size of Utah. They control 7 or 8 million people. We're fighting a war against them. I mean, we're gearing up to fight a war against them. Things aren't going very well. So I would say the drone program's been very clearly and obviously, with anyone half a brain, has been a bit of a bust.
Andrew Coburn is the author of Kill Chain: The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. He's Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. Always great to talk to you, Andrew.
Likewise.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.